to stand with me.
He's good with her, she softly says. He is. I smile for my friend.
We hear Melinda's shrill voice now.
Hiya, Marvin Harris. Hiya, please.
He gradually pushes harder. He touches his daughter's back with both hands, and she laughs loud and pure into the sky. When she's had enough, Marv stops the swing. The girl climbs off and grabs his hand and walks her father back toward us. Even from far away, I can see that Marv has tears on his face, as clear as glass. Marv's smile and the giant glass tears on his face are two of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. 10 of Hearts. Audrey, Part 1. 3 Nights to Wait. I don't sleep that night, the day of the swings. With each passing moment, I see Marv pushing that girl into the air, or I see him walking back with her, hand in hand. Close to midnight, I hear Marv's voice at the door. When I open it, he stands there, looking exactly how he feels. Come out, he says, and when I do, my friend Marvin Harris hugs me. He hugs me so hard that I can smell him and taste the joy that leaks from inside him. So Richie and Marv are done. I've delivered those messages as best I can. Now, there's only one left. Audrey. I don't want to waste time. I've come so far since the holdup. I've plowed through 11 messages, and this is the last of them. The most important one. The next night, I go straight to Audrey's place and watch. For a while, I expect Daryl and Keith to show up again, but they don't. I know what I'm doing, and whenever that's the case, I seem to be left alone. I don't sit exactly across from Audrey's place, but in a small park a bit further down her street. It's a new playground, all plastic and small. The grass is trimmed and neat. Her townhouse is in one of those complexes with about 8 or 9 other places. They all seem stapled together. The cars are parked out front in rows. I go there 3 nights. Each time, Simon shows up, but he never sees me camped out in the park. He has his mind firmly on Audrey and what they're going to do. Even from the distance of the park, I can see the desire on him as he drives in. Once he's inside, I walk closer to the letterboxes and look. They eat. They have sex. They drink. They have more sex. The sound of it slides under the door as I stand there, remembering the conversation I had with Simon at Christmas when he picked me up at Miller's. I know what I have to give to Audrey. Audrey doesn't love anyone. She refuses. But she loves me. She loves me, and for one moment in time, she needs to allow it. She needs to hold it. Know it completely. Just once. All 3 nights, I stay till morning. Simon leaves before the sun comes up. He must be rostered on for early morning in the city. On the 3rd night, I think it. Tomorrow. Yes, I'll do it tomorrow. Jack of Hearts. Marv's afterthought. Just before I head over to Audrey's place the next night, Marv's at my front door again. This time with a question. I walk out, and he refuses to follow me. From the porch, he says, "Do you still need that money, Ed?" He looks at me, concerned. "I'm sorry. I forgot all about it." "Don't worry," I tell him. "I don't think I'll be needing it after all. I've got an old derelict cassette player under my arm with a tape inside it." As I walk, Marv throws his voice out and ropes me back to face him. He looks at me thoughtfully and says, "Did you ever need it?" I walk closer. "No," I shake my head. "No, Marv, I didn't."
"Then why?"
He comes down the steps to face me properly.
"Then why did you say..."
"I kept that card I got in the mail, Marv. If Richie deserved the truth, so does Marv. I explain it to him. All of it. Marv, I've been through diamonds, clubs, spades, and I've got one more heart to go."
"Was that where I..."
"Yes, Marv," I answer. "You were in hearts." Quiet. Perplexed. Marv stands on my front lawn and has no idea what to say. but he looks happy. When I'm nearly gone, he calls out, "Is the last one Audrey?" I turn and look at him, walking backward.
"Well, good luck,"
he answers. This time I smile and wave. Queen of Hearts, Audrey, Part 2. 3 minutes to take. It all happens as usual, except tonight, the radio I've brought sweats next to me as the moon rises, falls, and fades when morning finally approaches. I wonder for a moment why I didn't just set my alarm at home and come over at dawn, but I know I have to do this right. I had to suffer the night to do this properly. My legs stretch out, but the night stretches further. First light frightens me. I'm swaying towards sleep in the park when I hear a door slam and Simon's car start up. He exits the townhouse complex with a quiet, clumsy turn onto the street. A minute passes, but I realize that now is the time. It all feels right. The radio, the light, and now my footsteps toward Audrey's front door. I knock. No answer. Again, I clench my fist, but just as I'm about to hit the wood again, a crack appears in the doorway and Audrey's tired voice edges through it.
"Did you forget some?"
Her voice props. "It's me," I say.
"Head?"
"Yes."
"What are you?"
My shirt feels like cement. I wear wooden jeans, sandpaper socks, and anvil shoes. "I'm here," I whisper, "for you." Audrey, the girl, the woman, is in a pink nightie. She opens the door and stands barefoot, removing some sleep from her eye with her fist. She reminds me of the little girl, Angelina. Slowly, I take her hand and bring her out onto the path. The heaviness has left me now, and it's just her and me. I place the radio in the bark-spattered garden, crouch down, and press play. At first, a moderate static rustles through the air. Then the music begins, and we can both hear the slow, quiet, sweet desperation of a song I won't mention. Imagine the softest, toughest, most beautiful song you know, and you've got it. We breathe it in, and my eyes hook with Audrey's. I walk closer and hold her hands.
"Ed, what?"
"Shh." I hold her close now around her hips, and she holds me back. She places her hands around my neck and rests her head on my shoulder. I can smell the sex on her, and my only hope is that she can smell the love on me. The music hits low. The voice reaches high. It's the music of hearts again, but much better this time, and we move and turn, and Audrey's breath places itself on my neck.
"Hmm,"
she moans gently, and we dance on the path. We hold each other. At one point, I let go and twirl her slowly. She comes back, and it's a small, small kiss she gives me on the neck when she returns. "I love you," I feel like saying, but there's no need for that. The sky flows with fire, and I'm dancing with Audrey. Even when the song ends, we hold on a little longer, and I think it's about 3 minutes we danced for. 3 minutes to tell her I love her. 3 minutes for her to admit she loves me back. She tells me when we let go, but no words of love exit her mouth. She just kind of closes one eye at me and says,
"Well, Ed Kennedy, huh?"
I smile. She points her finger.
"But only you, though, right?"
"Right, I agree." I stare at Audrey's bare feet, her ankles, her shins, then make my way up to her face. I take a photo of her in my mind, her tired eyes and morning mucked-up hair the color of straw, the smile gently scratching her lips, her small ears and smooth nose, and the last remnants of love holding strangely on. She let herself love me for 3 minutes. Can 3 minutes last forever? I ask myself, but already I know the answer. Probably not, I reply, but maybe they last long enough. King of Hearts. The end. I pick up the radio and we stand for a little while longer. She doesn't invite me in, and I don't ask. What needed to be done was done. So I turn and say, well, I'll see you, Audrey. Maybe at the next card game. Maybe before. Soon, she assures me, and with the radio tucked back under my arm, I begin to walk home. 12 messages have been delivered. 4 aces have been completed. This feels like the greatest day of my life. I'm alive, I think. I won. I feel freedom for the first time in months, and an air of contentedness wanders next to me all the way home. It even remains as I walk through the front door, kiss the doorman, and make us some coffee in the kitchen. We're halfway through it when another feeling finds its way to my stomach, winds up, and spills. I don't know why I feel it, but any contentment vanishes instantly as the doorman looks up at me. We hear a latch open and shut from outside, and a person rush off. I walk slowly out the door, down the porch steps, and onto the front yard. My letterbox stands there, slightly crooked. It looks guilty. My heart shakes. I walk on and shudder as I open the letterbox. Oh, no, I think. No, no, no! My hands reach in and my fingers take hold of one last envelope. My name's on it, and inside, I can already see it. There's one last card. One last address. I close my eyes and fall to my knees on my front lawn. My thoughts stammer. One last card. Without thinking, I gradually open the envelope. And when my eyes find the address, all thoughts are cut down and left there to die. It reads, 26 Shipping Street. The address is my address. The last message is for me. Part 5. The Joker. The Laughter. The street is empty and silent. The Joker laughs at me. Everything's quiet but for the silent laughter of the clown in my hands. He roars. The grass is covered with sweat, and I stand alone with the wild card between my fingers. I've been watched all along, but never have I felt as vulnerable or scrutinized as right now. Inside, I panic. What's waiting inside? Get in there, I say, and I walk across the sweat-soaked grass. Of course, I don't want to go inside, but what other choice do I have? If someone's in there, there's nothing I can do about it. My feet print the cement porch with wetness. I walk through to the kitchen. Anyone there? I call out. But there's no one in my kitchen. In fact, there's no one in my house at all, except the doorman, the Joker, and me. I all but check under the bed, even though I know it wouldn't be the style of what's been happening. They'd be drinking my coffee, or taking a leak in my toilet, or having a bath, or something like that. There's nothing and no one in my house. Silence pervades everything, until the doorman yawns and licks his lips. Hours pass until I have to go to work. Where to? Martin Place, please. With each pickup, I grow more numb. And for the first time ever, I don't speak to a person all day. I don't discuss the weather, I don't talk about who won on the weekend, the state of the roads, or any disposable conversational crap that fills the void inside a taxi cab. That's the first day. The second's the same. On the third day, something happens. I'm on my way back home when I nearly crash at a roundabout. A camper van in front of me attempts to go, but I look right instead of staying focused on the van. It stops abruptly, the brakes yell at my feet, and I manage to stop a few inches from the camper van's number plate. I have the Joker on the passenger seat. It springs forward, it lands on the floor, and laughs. The Weeks. Have you ever stretched your legs or touched your toes and tried for too much? That's how the days and weeks feel now as I work and wait for the Joker to unveil itself. What will happen at my shack, at 26 Shipping Street? Who will arrive? On February 7, a hand reaches at my door, and I half rush, half stall on my way there. Is this it? It's Audrey. She walks in and says, "You've been quiet lately, Ed. Marv says he's been trying to call you, but you haven't been home."
"I've been working."
"And?"
"Waiting."
She sits down on the couch and asks, "For what?" In no rush, I stand and walk to the drawer in the bedroom and pull out the four cards. When I return to her, I go through them one by one. "Diamonds," I say. "Done." I let go and watch it flutter to the floor. "Clubs?" "Done." Again, the card hits the carpet. "Spades and hearts?" "Both done." "So what now?" Audrey can see the paleness of my face and the jaded look of the rest of me. From my pocket, I pull the joker. "This," I state. And I beg her. I nearly weep as I say, "Tell me, Audrey. Please tell me it's you. Say you've been sending me these cards." I plead with her. "Tell me you just wanted me to help people and..."
"And what, Ed?"
I close my eyes. "Make myself better. Make me worth something." The words fall to the floor, to the cards, and Audrey smiles. She smiles, and I wait for her to admit it. "Tell me," I demand. "Tell..." She folds. She tells the truth. The words flow almost unconsciously from her mouth.
"No, Ed," she says slowly. "It wasn't me."
She shakes her head and faces me.
"I'm sorry, Ed. I'm so sorry. I wish it was, but..."
She doesn't finish her sentence. The end is not the end. Finally, it comes. Another knock rattles at my door, and I know this one feels right. It's late, the hand is harsh, and I place my shoes on my feet before I go to answer it.
"Breathe deep, Ed."
I do. "Stay here," I order the doorman, when he meets me in the hall, but he follows me back to the door. When I open it, there's a man in a suit. "Ed Kennedy?" He's bald and has a lengthy mustache.
"Yes," I say.
He comes closer to the doorway and says, "I have something for you. Can I come in?" He's friendly enough, and I decide that if he wants to come in, I should allow it. I step aside and let the man past. He's tall and middle-aged, and his voice is steeped with politeness and assertion. "Coffee?" I ask, but he declines.
"No, thank you."
This is the first time I see the briefcase in his hand. He sits and opens it, and inside he has a wrapped lunch, an apple, and an envelope.
"Sandwich?" he offers.
"No, thanks."
"Good decision.
My wife makes an awful sandwich. I couldn't bear to eat it today." Quickly he turns to business, handing me the envelope.
"Thanks."
I speak with trepidation.
"You going to open it?"
"Who sent you?" I shoot him through the eyes, and the man is taken aback for a moment.
"Open it. Who sent you?"
I can't hold myself any longer, though. My fingers work their way inside the envelope, and the familiar handwriting greets me.
"Dear Ed, the end is near. I think you'd best be getting down to the cemetery."
"The cemetery?" I ask, and I know that tomorrow is exactly a year to the day that my father died.
"My father? My father?" I say to the man. "Tell me, was it him?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"Why not?"
I nearly take hold of him.
"I..."
he begins.
"What?"
"I was sent here."
"By who?"
But the man can only bow his head. He speaks the words with purpose.
"I don't know. I don't know who he is."
"Was my father behind it?" I talk at him. "Did he organize all this before he died? Did he..." I hear what my mother said to me last year.
"You're just like him."
Did my father leave instructions for someone to organize this? I remember seeing him walk the streets at night when I was in my cab. He did it to sober up. I'd pick him up once in a while as he made his way home from the pub.
That's how he knew the addresses,
I say aloud. Sorry? Nothing, I answer, and no more words are spoken because I'm out the door. I'm running up the street and out to the cemetery. The night is that blue-black color. Clouds like cement are paved in sections to the sky. The cemetery looms up, and I turn to the area where my father's grave is. Some security guards are standing close by.
Or are they?
No. It's Daryl and Keith. I slow to a standstill, and they watch me. Daryl speaks.
Congratulations, Ed.
I catch up to my breath.
My father?
I ask.
You are like he was, Keith enlightens me. And just like him, you are most likely to die the same way. A quarter of what you could have been.
So he sent you to do this? He organized it before he died? Daryl answers the question, wandering closer. You see, Ed, you're always an absolute no-hoper. Just like your old man. No offense. None taken. And we've been employed to test you. To see if you can avoid this life. He points casually to the grave.
The only problem is, Keith steps in now, it wasn't your father who sent us.
This takes a while to sink in. It's not Audrey. It's not my father. Crowds of questions string through me, like lines of people exiting a football game or a concert. They push and shove and trip. Some make their way around. Some remain in their seats, waiting for their opportunity. What are you doing here, then? I ask them. How did you know I'd be right here at this exact moment in time?
Our employer sent us, Daryl replies.
He told us you'd be here, Keith chimes in again.
They're working well tonight.
So we came.
He smiles at me, almost sympathetically.
He hasn't been wrong yet.
I try to think, to make some sense of all this. Well, I begin, but it appears that I have no more words to extend the sentence. I find them. Who's your employer?
Daryl shakes his head. We don't know, Ed. We just do what we're told.
He begins to wrap things up. But yes, Ed, you were sent here tonight to remind yourself that you don't want to die the same way your father did. Understand? I nod my agreement. And now, we have one last thing to tell you, and then we'll disappear from your life forever. I prepare to listen hard. What is it? They already begin to walk away. Just that you have a little longer to wait, okay? I stand there. What else can I do but stand there? I watch Daryl and Keith walk calmly into the night. They're gone, and I'll never see them again. Thank you, I say, but they don't hear me. It seems a shame that they never will. A few more days pass, and I realize there's nothing else I can do now but wait. I've almost given up when I'm waved down by a young man in jeans, a jacket, and a cap on my way home from work one morning at dawn. He gets in the back seat, the usual. I ask him where to, the usual. Then I get the answer.
26 Shipping Street.
Not the usual. The words paralyze me, and I nearly pull the car to a stop.
Just drive on, he says,
but he doesn't look up.
Like I told you, Ed, 26 Shipping Street.
I drive. We travel in silence until we make it to town. I'm driving cautiously, with nervous eyes and a badly beating heart. I turn onto my street and pull up at my place. Finally, the person in the back seat removes his cap and looks up so I can see him for the first time in the mirror.
It's you,
I shout.
Yes.
Something greater than shock or surprise has stolen every thought or reaction I might have had, because in the back seat of my cab is the failed bank robber from the start of this story. His ginger whiskers are still there, and he's as ugly as ever.
The 6 months are up, he explains.
He sounds friendly this time.
But...
Don't ask questions, he interrupts. Just drive on. Drive me to 45 Edgar Street.
I do it.
Remember this place? He asks.
I do.
Now, 13 Harrison Avenue. And one by one, the failed bank robber takes me to each place. To Mella and Sophie, to the father and Angie Caruso, and to the Rose Boys. Remember? He questions me each time. In the cab, I revisit each place, each message. Yes, I tell him. I do.
Good. Glory Road now.
Clown Street and your ma's place.
Bell Street.
And you know the last three. We drive the streets of town as the sun climbs higher in the sky. We go to Richie's, to the playground with the unkempt grass, and to Audrey's place. At each destination, remembering takes its turn in me as I drive. At times, it makes me want to stop and stay. Stay forever. With Richie in the river. With Marv at the swings. And dancing with Audrey in the silent fire of morning. Where now? I ask when we return to my place.
Get out, he tells me. And now I can't help it. I say,
it was you, wasn't it? You robbed the bank knowing that...
Oh, could you just shut up, Ed?
We stand by the cab in the morning sun. Methodically, he pulls something from his jacket pocket. It's a small, flat mirror.
Remember what I told you, Ed, at my trial?
I remember, and for some reason, I feel a warmness in my eyes.
Tell me.
You said that every time I look in the mirror, I should remember I'm looking at a dead man.
That's right.
The failed thief steps away and stands in front of me. A small smile lands on his face, and he holds the mirror up to me. I stare right into myself. He says,
are you looking at a dead man now?
In a flood inside me, I see all those places and people again. I hold the kid on her porch and go by the name of Jimmy to a marvelous old woman. I watch a girl run with the most glorious bloodied feet in the world. I laugh with the thrill on a religious man's face. I see Angie Caruso's ice-creamed lips and feel the loyalty of the Rose Boys. I watch the darkness of a family lit up by the power and the glory. Let my mother unleash the truth and love and disappointment of her life and sit in a lonely man's cinema. Looking into the mirrored glass, I stand with my friend in a river. I watch Marvin Harris push his daughter on a swing high into the sky. And I dance with Love and Audrey for 3 minutes straight.
Well, he asks again, are you still looking at a dead man?
This time, I answer. I say, no. And the criminal speaks.
Well, it was worth it then.
He went to jail for those people. He went to jail for me. And now he walks away with a few last words.
Goodbye, Ed.
I think you better get inside. And he's gone. Just like Daryl and Keith, I will never see him again.
The folder. As calmly as I can, I walk inside. My front door was open. On my couch, there sits a young man who pats the doorman very quietly and happily.
Who up?
Hi, Ed, he says. I'm glad to finally meet you.
Are you?
He nods.
You sent...
He nods again.
When he stands up, he says,
I came to this town a year ago, Ed.
He has fairly short brown hair, stands a bit smaller than medium height, and wears a shirt, black jeans, and blue athletic shoes. As each minute passes, he looks more like a boy than a man, although when he speaks, his voice is not a boy's at all.
Yeah, it was about a year ago, and I saw your father buried. I saw you and your card games and your dog and your ma. I just kept coming back, watching. The same way you did at all those addresses.
He turns away for a moment, almost ashamed.
I killed your father, Ed.
I organized the bungled bank robbery for a time when you were there. I instructed that man to brutalize his wife I made Daryl and Keith do all those things to you, and your mate who took you to the stones. He looks down, then up. I did it all to you. I made you a less than competent taxi driver and got you to do all those things you thought you couldn't. We stand now, staring, waiting for more words. And why? He pauses, but he doesn't move back. I did it because you are the epitome of ordinariness, Ed. He looks at me seriously. And if a guy like you can stand up and do what you did for all those people, well, maybe everyone can. Maybe everyone can live beyond what they're capable of. He becomes intense now, emotional. This is everything. Maybe even I can. He sits back down on the couch. I recall the sensation of the town feeling painted around me and a feeling invented. Is this happening? It is, and the young man sits there rinsing his hand through his hair. Quietly, he stands up and looks back at the couch. There's a faded yellow folder sitting on a cushion. It's all in there, he says. Everything. Everything I wrote for you, every idea I scratched around with, every person you helped, hurt, or ran into. But my words feel smeared. How? Even this, he answers, is in there. This discussion. Shocked, amazed, dumbfounded, I stand. Eventually, I manage to speak again. Am I real? He barely even thinks about it. He doesn't need to. Look in the folder, he says. At the end. See it? In large scrawled letters on the blank side of a cardboard beer coaster, it's written. His answer is written there in black ink. It says, "Of course you're real. Like any thought or any story. It's real when you're in it." He says, "I better go now. You probably want to go through that folder and check for consistency. It's all there." For a moment, I panic. It's that feeling of falling when you know without question that you've lost control of your car or made a mistake that's beyond repair. "What do I do now?" I ask desperately. "Tell me, what do I do now?" He remains calm. He looks at me closely and says, "Keep living, Ed. It's only the pages that stop here." He stays for perhaps another 10 minutes, probably due to the trauma that has strapped itself to me. I remain standing, trying to contemplate and recover from what's just transpired. "I really think I better go," he says again, this time with more finality. With difficulty, I walk him to the door. We say goodbye on the front porch, and he walks back up the street. I wonder about his name, but I'm sure I'll learn it soon enough. He's written about this, I'm sure, the bastard. All of it. As he walks up the street, he pulls a small notebook from his pocket and writes a few things down. It makes me think that maybe I should write about all this myself. After all, I'm the one who did all the work. I'd start with the bank robbery. Something like, "The gunman is useless." The odds are, however, that he's beaten me to it already. It'll be his name on the cover of all these words, not mine. He'll get all the credit. All the crap, if he does a shit job. But just remember that I was the one, not him, who gave life to these pages. I was the one who... I tell me to stop. It's an inner voice, and it's loud. All day, I think about many things, though I try not to. I look through the folder and find everything as he said. All the ideas are written in and people are sketched. Scratchy excerpts are stapled together. Beginnings and endings merge and bend. Hours wander past. Days follow them. I don't leave the shack, and I don't answer the phone. I barely even eat. The doorman sits with me as the minutes pass by. For a long time, I wonder what I'm waiting for, but I understand it's just like he said. I guess it's for life beyond these pages. The message. One afternoon, I hear what feels like the last knock at my door, and standing there, on my cracked front porch, is Audrey. Her eyes dangle for a moment, and she asks to come in. In the hallway, she falls back against the door and says, "Can I stay, Ed?"
I go to her.
"Of course you can stay the night." But she shakes her head and her dangling eyes finally fall. Audrey walks forward and reaches into me.
"Not for tonight," she says. "For good."
We sink to the floor of my hallway and Audrey kisses me. Her lips join up with mine and I taste her breath and swallow and feel and lunge for it. It streaks inside me with streams of her beauty. I hold her yellow hair. I touch the smooth skin of her neck and she keeps kissing me. She wants to. When we finish, the doorman walks to us and settles down at my side.
"Hey, doorman,"
Audrey says, and again her eyes stream. She looks happy. The doorman looks at both of us. He is the sage. He is the wisdom. He says,
"About bloody time, you two."
We stay in the hall for close to an hour, and I tell Audrey everything. She listens intently as she pats the doorman, and she believes me. I realize that Audrey has always believed me. I'm about to relax completely when a final question slips inside me. It tries to get up, but slips over again. "The folder," I say. I get up and walk hurriedly to the lounge room. On my knees, I go through the folder incessantly. I sit there and comb through it. I rummage and plow among the loose papers.
"What are you doing?"
Audrey asks. She's come in and stands behind me. I turn and look up at her. "I'm looking for this," I tell her. I wave my hand at both of us. "I'm looking for you and me, together." And Audrey only crouches down. She kneels with me and places her hand on mine to make me drop the papers.
"I don't think it's in there,"
she says it softly.
"I think, Ed."
Her hands hold me now gently on my face. The orange light of late afternoon is attached to her.
"I think this belongs to us."
It's evening now, and Audrey and I share a coffee with the doorman on the front porch. He smiles at me when he's finished and falls into his normal, gentle sleep by the door. Caffeine doesn't affect him anymore. Audrey's fingers hold on to mine. The light remains a few moments longer, and I hear the words again from this morning. "If a guy like you can stand up and do what you did, then maybe everyone can. Maybe everyone can live beyond what they're capable of." And that's when I realize. In a sweet, cruel, beautiful moment of clarity, I smile, watch a crack in the cement, and speak to Audrey and the sleeping doorman. I tell them what I'm telling you. I'm not the messenger at all. I'm the message. This is Mark Aidan Gray. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of I Am the Messenger by Marcus Zusak. This program was produced and directed by Scott Cresswell. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2002 by Marcus Zusak. Production copyright 2006, Random House Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.